This is a summary of Putin's People by bestbookbriefings.com. Putin's People: How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took on the West. By Catherine Belton. This book was intended to trace how Putin's former KGB colleagues took over the Russian economy, but it quickly became much more than that. Research and current events showed that Putin's kleptocracy was intended for more than just enriching the president's friends. Billions of dollars were actively being used in order to undermine the democratic institutions of the West. This tactic comes from the KGB's Cold War playbook, back when the Soviet Union would fund disruptive, active measures. But the difference is that today, those tactics are being funded by much deeper pockets. Russia has embraced capitalism as a tool of retaliation against the West. This process of change began long before the Soviet Union ever collapsed. 1. Operation Lutch. In 1992, Vladimir Putin was appointed as the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. A few months into his new job, he commissions a documentary about him that is carefully curated to give the impression of a strong, meticulous, progressive-leaning public official. Most importantly, Putin was keen to stress that he'd cut all ties to his previous employer, the KGB. But this was just the start of a long campaign of deceptive cover-ups. In the crumbling remains of the Soviet Empire, nothing was quite as it seemed. When Boris Yeltsin dissolved the Communist Party, he also broke up the KGB into four distinct domestic services. But in its place emerged a Hydra, an underground organization that many officers like Putin retreated to, in order to continue working from the shadows. A faction of the KGB had long been aware of the changing tides in Russia's political sphere, and had long been preparing for it. The secret plan in question was called Operation Lutch, and its purpose was to develop a network of agents that would continue to work for the Russians, long after the inevitable dissolution of communism. Preparations for this were being made as early as 1988, before the Empire of East Germany fell. In 1985, Putin was assigned to Dresden. Although it seemed like an unassuming backwater deep in East German territory, it was far more than that. Dresden was on the front line of the smuggling business that had been keeping East Germany alive for years. Organized crime groups worked in tandem with Soviet security services and the KGB to smuggle precious goods like cigarettes, alcohol, and rare metals into the black market. While the KGB's excellent ability to destroy incriminating information means that there is little to no hard evidence of Putin's role in these illegal dealings, businessmen like Martin Schlaff, who profited greatly from that era, would later go on to be central pillars that supported the Putin regime's influence operations. Moreover, a first-hand account from a former member of the far-left Red Army faction claims that Putin had worked to support the terrorist group. When the Berlin Wall fell, Putin and his fellow KGB officers were suddenly left out in the cold by the Soviet Union. They were left to fend for themselves, frantically burning evidence day and night before protesters could find them. When Putin called for reinforcements, the troops took hours to arrive. Moscow was silent. This seemed to him a betrayal of everything they had worked for. Perhaps this was the start of what would later be his public disillusionment of the promise of communism. It was clear that the Union had a terminal disease, a paralyzing loss of power. When Putin returned home to a turbulent and rapidly changing Russia, he decided to adapt. But instead of following the traditional path of serving the KGB's headquarters of foreign intelligence, Putin hitched his wagon to the rising star of the democratic movement in Leningrad. Putin's first job was at the Leningrad State University, where he served as a fixer for Anatoly Sobchak, then the school's professor of law, and future mayor of St. Petersburg. In a matter of weeks, Putin would be in a position that was at the top of Russia's democracy, all as planned by the KGB. 2. An inside job. In the days after the Communist Party's dissolution, Russia's new management was shocked to find that their accounts, estimated to hold billions of dollars, were almost empty. Russian prosecutors were deployed in order to investigate the rumors that officials had siphoned this money into foreign joint ventures. As they sorted through what remained of the Central Committee's archives, they found documents that pointed towards a variety of secret schemes that served this very purpose. One such scheme involved using friendly firms, crony companies that were at the center of the black market smuggling operations that had kept East Germany afloat for many years. Some of them were involved in selling necessary equipment to the Soviet Union's energy and manufacturing industries, but at vastly inflated prices. The profits would then be used to fund the Communist Party's activities in other countries. A list of 45 of these firms were found by the prosecutors, with at least one well-known figure, Robert Maxwell, owner of a publishing house that was known for facilitating the sale of Soviet science books for the West. Days before the list was published, his body was found floating in the Atlantic Ocean, not very far from his yacht. In 1991, right in the thick of Boris Yeltsin's democratic reforms, three men were reported to have committed suicide in suspiciously similar circumstances. All three were linked by their intimate knowledge of the secret financing systems that the KGB was preparing for the transition into a market economy. The prosecutors struck gold when they found Leonid Veselovsky, a former colonel for the KGB. Fearing the repercussions against him, he spoke openly about how he was a part of a group of top KGB operatives who had been drafted to help hide and manage the Communist Party's secret wealth. Veselovsky was an expert in international economics, and so he worked on the plan to create an invisible economy. This model of smuggling, friendly firms, and custodians would be the very same one that the Putin regime would run on. But in the middle of the prosecutors' investigations, Veselovsky disappeared without a trace, leaving them with another dead end. The transfer of the Communist Party's money created a new class of elite new rich tycoons who would also serve as shelters for many senior KGB operatives. With decades of Soviet control lifted, these oligarchs were free to become obscenely rich, at the expense of the Russian government and population as large. Hyperinflation ravaged the government's finances, and when more market reforms were created in response, the new elite profited from that, too. State enterprises were privatized in an effort to alleviate the government's burden of debt, but the only people who could afford to participate were the people who were responsible for the predicament in the first place, the young tycoons. The new Russia was determined to break the state's hold over the economy at any cost, but instead it created a ravenous monster that tainted their system and opened the way for further corruption. Soon, the young tycoons would outgrow their former KGB masters. But in St. Petersburg, where Putin was in charge, things were run a little differently. The KGB worked hand in hand with organized crime in order to create a slush fund for their future purposes, but the KGB exerted much more control over their dealings. In the KGB's eyes, the alliances they made were necessary in order to exert some control over the chaos of the Soviets' collapse. The organized groups were their infantry that they used to control the masses. The only person who ever spoke out publicly about their dealings in St. Petersburg was Anatoly Sobchak himself, the ineffective mayor at the time. Long after he retired, he wrote a newspaper article criticizing the actions of the KGB for the first and only time in his life. 4 months later, he was found dead. In 1996, Putin was suddenly appointed to a senior position in the Kremlin. This was the start of his dizzying rise to power. 7 months after he moved to Moscow, he was promoted once again as the head of the control department. A year later, he was assigned as the Kremlin's first deputy chief of staff in charge of the regions, making him the third most powerful man in the Kremlin after the president. After 3 months, he was appointed as the head of the FSB, the successor to the KGB. It was unheard for anyone who wasn't a general to be in that position, but Putin was only a lieutenant colonel at the time. A close ally surmises that Putin's transfers were planned. In Moscow, he was known as an advisor to Sobchak and an influential person in St. Petersburg. Yeltsin's son-in-law Valentin Yumashev would vouch for Putin's outstanding qualities as the main factor in his rise, but to many others, this rapid ascension was beginning to seem suspicious. 3. Someone like Putin. Putin has been portrayed as Russia's accidental president for a long time. But very little about his rise to power has been left to chance. Although it seemed like Yeltsin's Russia was a country of monumental change where the power of the KGB had long been dissolved, beneath the surface they were still a force to be reckoned with. Inside the Kremlin, and in posts all across the country's companies and institutions, representatives of the KGB watched from the shadows and waited for their time. The freedoms of the Yeltsin era had created a robber-style capitalism that fed the rise of the oligarchs who in turn compromised Yeltsin and his family. Thomas Graham, former senior director for Russia on the U.S. National Security Council, once said that the institutions for the KGB didn't break down, and neither did their personal networks. All they needed was an individual who could bring these networks together. If it hadn't been Putin, they would have found someone else like him. Putin spent his time in the Kremlin charming Yeltsin into believing that he was one of them, a progressive politician who shared their interests. as many accounts will attest. Putin's specialty is in molding and adapting his personality in order to suit the people he wants to influence. Putin was poised to take over. Despite that, his approval rating hardly grew in his first month as the premier. He was frequently described as a bland, colorless bureaucrat, who no one really knew anything about. Something else needed to happen. In September 1999, a series of explosions tore through various Russian cities, including Moscow, killing hundreds of people in the process. All of these incidents were attributed to separatist Chechen rebels, despite weak evidence. Panic spread through Russia at an unprecedented rate. As the nation's sense of fear and emergency grew, Vladimir Putin took the stage. Suddenly, he was Russia's commander-in-chief, leading a valiant campaign of airstrikes to strike back at Chechnya. As if on cue, Putin was now the action hero, confident and prepared to do what needed to be done. As civilian casualties soared, so did his approval ratings, jumping from 31% to 75% in months. Could the KGB have bombed their own people in a cynical attempt to create a crisis for his presidency? The answers are hard to find. Anyone who seriously investigated the matter seems to have died or unexpectedly been arrested in the process. But if there had been a plan, it seems to have worked spectacularly. The pro-Putin majority had arrived. In Yeltsin's memoirs, he describes Putin as reluctant to take power. Indeed, this was the impression the man had presented to the public, right up until the results of the elections. But this doesn't match the narrative that his actions paint. Months before the parliamentary elections even occurred, Putin has basically taken over Russia's army and law enforcement system. He couldn't have acted as decisively as he had there or with the military campaign against Chechnya if he wasn't already assured that he was going to be the president soon. In the final days of 1999, Putin addressed the FSB as such. The group of FSB operatives assigned to work undercover in the government have successfully accomplished the first stage of their task. His face was serious throughout the speech, but at the end, he couldn't help but smirk. Putin was essentially telling his fellow comrades that the country was finally theirs. 4. Putin's inner circle. In May 2000, Putin was inaugurated as Russia's next president. In the front rows of his audience were the Yeltsin family officials who'd been a part of his rise to power. But hidden in the crowd of officials in the hall were the KGB men that Putin brought with him all the way from St. Petersburg. At the time, they were rarely heard from, but they were the Slaviki who would later go on to make their presence very well known. For the first few years of Putin's first term, the Slaviki shared an uneasy alliance with Yeltsin's holdover staff, watching and learning. In line with the pro-market stance he'd used to appeal to the Yeltsin family, Putin announced a series of liberal reforms that earned him praises from economists all over the world, and convinced investors of his credibility. He introduced an incredibly competitive income tax rate of 13%, as well as land reforms that allowed for private property to be bought and sold. In the middle of all of this, the oil prices that Russia depended so much on finally started to rise. As such, Putin's administration started paying off the vast amounts of money that the previous administration had owed the IMF. It seemed that stability and order were finally being established. But Putin was just using the appearance of liberal economics as a way of strengthening the state's control. His early reforms were intended to establish a type of rule where economic reform was enforced with the totalitarian force of a strong state. There were signs that Putin was after a different kind of power. Optimists hoped that he was trying to pull off a balancing act between the relatively liberal and pro-Western leanings of his Yeltsin family staff with the St. Petersburg security men, but the influence of the KGB gradually began to outweigh everything else. They still saw the world from the lens that the Cold War had given them, the US as an opposing state that eternally sought to divide and weaken Russia. Despite Putin's declarations of further transitioning Russia into a market economy, his feelings on the oligarchs who had run rampant during Yeltsin's time were made very clear from the start. He was going to waste the leeches. In response to a campaign worker's question, he replied that his regime needed to do more than just destroy them. It was important to distance every single clan and oligarch from the power that they held. At the time, the oligarchs didn't take this seriously. They thought that he was a temporary figurehead that they could control with bribes and threats. But Putin's own inclinations, as well as the careful intervention of his KGB men, made this nigh impossible to achieve. 10 days after he was inaugurated, Putin revealed his plans to reduce the powers of Russia's regional governors by removing their seats in the Federation Council, and appointing 7 Kremlin-based plenipotentiary super-governors, if you will, to oversee their territory. Putin's men launched a series of raids on some of the country's largest business empires, like Lukoil, Media Most, and Avtovaz, the nation's largest car manufacturer. Putin's men used the criminal justice system as a blunt instrument blackmail with the intent of forcing a takeover. Russia's business community was beginning to panic, desperate to understand what the new rules of the game were. They begged to have an audience with him. In their first meeting with Putin, they were delivered a public dressing down. Putin's scathing comments about their culpability were delivered on national TV. Once the cameras were off, he made his terms clear: stay out of politics, or else. There were a couple of notable oligarchs who stood against Putin. Boris Berezovsky was the owner of the most popular channel in Russia, or TV. His channel was instrumental in transforming Putin's image before he was elected, but now, he made use of it in order to voice his criticisms against Putin's regime, making sure to denounce him at every possible opportunity. Putin took the threat of the media seriously, and focused the Kremlin's efforts on taking him down. They didn't stand a chance. Sooner rather than later, the free media of the Yeltsin years was under their control. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, then the owner of the majority of the Siberia oil fields under the name of the Yukos Group, was widely known as the richest man in Russia. His control over the precious resource, as well as his position of wealth, made him an urgent target for the Putin regime. The fact that he operated outside of their control was a massive red flag. In October 2003, he was forcefully arrested in Novosibirsk on charges of large-scale fraud and tax evasion, and detained. Khodorkovsky's arrest was the point of no return for Russia's political and economic future. If he could be taken down, anyone could be. Russia was turned away from integrating with the rest of the world, and onto a collision course with the West. In a way, the fates of these oligarchs were the KGB's revenge for having been forced to wait on the sidelines in the 90s as the tycoons rose to power. They felt that everything these new billionaires had won was owed to them. The Kremlin's new masters had tasted power, and they wanted more. The myth that they told themselves was that they were the guardians of Russia's restoration saviors that deserved to build their own fortunes. Besides, if they didn't take back the resources in the name of nation, the Americans would surely buy their way into control. In a nutshell, this new era of state capitalism was just greed disguised as a higher cause. 5. The Empire Awakens. While the holdovers from the Yeltsin family balked at these radical changes and began to run for the exits, Putin's KGB men sought to tie him down to the presidency. His inner circle pressed him to stay, threatening that there would be nowhere else for him to go after his administration's actions. With that said, Putin was getting used to his role. In fact, he was developing a taste for it. Those who once served above him were now bowing down before him, lavishing him with extravagant praise and hailing him as the savior of Russia. All of this kowtowing gradually went to Putin's head, and he began to see himself as a czar for a new age. He was emboldened to take tougher, more authoritarian decisions, and really take the state apparatus into his own hands. In line with all of this, Putin's KGB men proposed a new ideology that was intended to restore the former greatness of the Russian state, and establish their imperial ties with former Soviet republics. One of Putin's first presidential acts was to reinstate the Soviet anthem, the Unbreakable Union of Freeborn Republics, a powerful hymn that was originally written in honor of Stalin and Russia's feats as a global power, as well as the great sacrifices that were made along the way. Alongside this call to honor their Soviet past, a new passion for the Orthodox Church arose with Putin and the ruling elite at large. It may seem strange for a KGB officer who spent most of his career serving a state that outlawed the Orthodox Church to profess a belief in it, but it was instrumental in forming this new national identity. The tenets of the Orthodox Church provided a unifying structure from beyond the Soviet era to the days of their imperialist past, and provided a mystical belief that Russia was meant to be the Third Rome, the next ruling empire of the world. One member of Putin's inner circle described this new imperial philosophy as a knot with three elements. The first knot was an autocratic government, a strong man, like a papa, or a boss. The second knot was the fatherland territory, and love of country. The third knot, which brought everything together, was the church. Putin was very careful to bring these three together. Take one of them away, and the whole thing would collapse. Before this change, Putin's State of the Nation addresses were focused mainly on the economy, on doubling the GDP, creating a comfortable life for citizens, and integrating Russia into the global economy. But in the year this philosophy was solidified, his speech had another tone to it. Russia should continue its mission of civilization for Eurasia. We consider international support for the respect of the rights of Russians abroad of major importance, once that cannot be the subject of political and bargaining. Things could have turned out differently if Putin's KGB men had used Russia's wealth to strengthen their economic and democratic institutions, instead of preserving and projecting their own power. If the hardcore Slavaki had seen the West as a potential partner, and not as an inevitable enemy, then none of this would have been an issue. But these men lived in a world where the Cold War had never truly ended, and the only thing that mattered was regaining Russia's former power. In this world, the West, through NATO, crept closer and closer to Russia's borders, posing an existential threat. Democracy movements that overthrew the pro-Russia governments of Ukraine and Georgia were US-backed revolutions, not an expression of their people's will. All of these paranoias were born by the collapse of an empire, and grounded in a bitter sense of defeat, and they were held by men who grew more and more ruthless in their pursuit of power. 6. Following the money. When a mysterious whistleblower leaked gigabytes of data from a Panama-based law firm, the world suddenly got a look at the inside operations of the Putin regime slush fund. This data leak would be known as the Panama Papers, and it would open a world into a dark, secret world. One of the things that people were documents that related to a Russian called Sergei Roldugin. He was a shareholder in Bank Rossiya, a St. Petersburg bank that was owned by Putin's KGB allies, and known to the US Treasury as a personal bank for the Russian government's senior officials. These documents exposed an offshore system that was not only a way to build up personal wealth, but also to create a wider system of black cash and assets so large it could be used to create influence abroad. The scale of Russian capital movement into Western bank accounts was mind-boggling. Research shows that at least $800 billion has been stashed offshore since the collapse of the Soviet Union, more money than Russia's population itself holds. Criminals and legitimate businessmen alike used this system as a way of safekeeping their money, a clear sign of the risks inherent in the Russian economy. While the rising oil prices and increasing stability of Putin's regime should have staunched the country's loss of capital, the flow of money would instead multiply many times over. This weakened Russia's economy, but Putin did little to stop it after all. His own inner circle was a vital element of the siphoning process. Meanwhile, bloated state contracts had become a new path to riches for Putin's men. The Sochi Winter Olympics infrastructure costs jumped from $12 billion to $50 billion, making them the history's most expensive Olympics. Most of the contracts involved were given exclusively to Putin's closest allies. They were being elevated above everyone else. They had their own banks, their own roads, and their own rules. The former KGB operatives regarded all of this as their just rewards. They told themselves that they'd saved Russia from the clutches of the Yeltsin-era oligarchs, and they were resurrecting Russia as a shield against the West. They even went so far as to award themselves commemorative medals. To the outside world, all of this looked like simple cronyism and corruption. But the scale of the cash coming in was to the point that it couldn't have been motivated solely by greed. The black cash operations that they fund are Russia's most powerful weapon today. As a former senior KGB officer puts it, you can't use a nuke every day, but you can use black cash as much as you want. At any time, it can be deployed to dismantle the Western Empire from the inside. 7. Donald Trump. When Shalva Chihirinsky met Donald Trump for the very first time in 1990, he'd already been living in the West for more than 3 years. He'd left the Soviet Union long before it fell in order to be with his wife, who was a Spanish citizen who'd left Russia before him. But this marriage was a fiction. Before Chihirinsky had left, he'd been befriended by two visionaries in the Soviet Foreign Intelligence Division, Russian spymaster Yevgeny Primakov, and the former head of Soviet military intelligence for the United States, Mikhail Milstein. Chihirinsky had trained as a doctor in Moscow, but his real business was in smuggling antiques into the West. During his career, one branch of the KGB pursued him for his illegal activities. Their minds were grooming and encouraging him. Chihirinsky would begin to forge a close relationship with Trump that was the foundation for a network of Russian agents, oligarchs, and organized crime associates that would surround the American ever since. All of these people were part of a web of figures that were powered by the KGB's black cash system. Some of them would bail Trump out of his failed real estate ventures and offer him lucrative construction deals that would only require his name for a healthy paycheck. One of them even organized 2013's Miss Universe pageant in Moscow for him. The money that flowed from them into Trump's business operations is yet to be fully discovered, as they are at the center of a legal standoff between Trump and Congress. But the shape of Moscow's influence over Trump can be traced through them. Chigorinsky and his colleagues were among the first of the KGB's experiments in funneling money into the West, operating in the dark spaces between the Russian security service and the mob. Later generations of shadow bankers would invent new ways of laundering and utilizing this black cash, but before that, it seemed that one of the channels that they focused on were Donald Trump's business dealings. There is no evidence that Trump was aware of any potential risks or issues with the Soviet businessmen he dealt with in the early 2000s. In fact, there is no evidence to show that he did any due diligence with his research on them. In those days, Trump was strapped for cash. Any aid must have been welcome. When Trump decided to run for president in 2015, Chigorinsky was still close by as he ramped up his bid for election. The very same Russian network stepped up its courtship of him, to the point that Russian informants found incriminating evidence regarding Hillary Clinton's emails, which would prove to be crucial for the election results. When he won, the Russians couldn't believe their luck. On that day, the Russian parliament leapt to their feet in riotous applause. Champagne flowed freely that night. Was all this part of Russia's secret operations to install their man in the White House? If not, then what was the point of all the cultivation and links to Trump beforehand? Was it all planned meticulously, or just sheer opportunism? Whatever the case, Trump's victory was Putin's victory. Konstantin Zachulin, a leading Russian lawmaker, said of this, "While the West was playing James Bond, we focused on gaining respect. When the West thought the Cold War was over, they lost their respect for the enemy. Now they wake up to this again." Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.